So I'm here at HINS 2024 in Orlando, Florida, with over 30,000 other attendees who are healthcare leaders and innovators from across the world. Here at the event, I'm chatting with speakers and attendees and exhibitors to get the lay of the land and the latest insights in the current and future trends of healthcare technology. And here in this special feature episode for HINS 24 of the Talking Health Tech podcast, I'll be speaking with clinicians and innovators, executives and more on how they're tackling some of the biggest issues around patient access and health equity, cost containment, regulation, interoperability, and a lot more. Now, I'm doing so many interviews here at HIMSS that I won't be able to feature all of those discussions in this one podcast episode. So once you've checked out this episode, all of the other discussions that I had here at HIMSS are available on our YouTube channel, so go check that out. But right now, here are just some of the conversations I had here at HIMSS 2024. Collaboration starts with a conversation, Team Health Tech. Let's make it happen.
Welcome to Talking Health Tech, featuring content and community about technology and healthcare. We acknowledge the traditional owners of lands these conversations were recorded and pay respect to elders past and present.
Between now and the end of June, we're conducting the 2024 Talking Health Tech Audience Survey. This helps us prioritize content, hone in key messages, and refine the show to make it even better. We also want to understand who the biggest cohorts of our audience are. So I'd love for you to take 5 or 10 minutes to have your say and complete the survey. Everyone who completes it goes in the draw to win a share of $1,000 worth of THT Plus membership credits to put towards a membership for yourself as an individual or to help get the word out about your company. The link to complete the survey is in the show notes of this episode, or just go to talkinghealthtech.com/survey.
I'm Ann Snowden. I'm the Chief Scientific Research Officer for HIMSS. I'm a nurse by training. I'm also a full professor at a Canadian university, and I do a lot of research on where and how does digital maturity matter and to whom. So that's, in a nutshell, who I am and where I'm from.
Digital maturity is an important topic in the healthcare space, and there's been a lot of maturing in the past couple of years going on. Tell me a little bit more about what that entails and the type of research you do and what you're finding.
Yeah, it's a good question. Health systems talk a lot about all the many incredible technologies out there. This year at the HIMSS conference, of course, artificial intelligence is a big topic, right? In fact, artificial intelligence is 20 years old. I built my first machine learning algorithm in 2008, but, you know, all to say it's been around a while, but healthcare is a sector that's actually quite slow to adopt these technologies at scale, meaning can every person everywhere have the opportunity to be healthier or well or solve a health challenge with access to all the latest and greatest technologies? And the answer is not really. And in the case of AI, particularly not really. It's been in the research space for a very long time. But some of the research we're doing is to look at digital maturity in hospitals. You know, that's one part of the health system. It's not the whole health system. And what are the outcomes they achieve if you're really advanced compared to those who are not at all?
Yeah. Like that's important, isn't it? Because when I think from the different stakeholders' perspectives, if I'm looking from a hospital perspective, then potentially an implementation of technology might come more from the office of the CFO if it's relating to cost containment or getting efficiencies within the clinic setting. And hey, if we get patient outcomes, then that's great too. Whereas on the, say, investment side, it could be that, we can speak about all these cool emerging technologies and trends, and won't this be great how it'll shape the future? And hey, by the way, patients might have good outcomes. In the end, ultimately, that's the most important part. And so it's sometimes the challenge can be genuinely bringing those patient outcomes to front of mind when it comes to technology implementations. Is that kind of similar to the position that you take on it?
Absolutely. The technologies are fabulous. Hmm. And sometimes I hear about them from many very, very talented people, companies developing them. And it almost feels like it's selling a dream.
Hmm.
Because what really matters in healthcare is, who are the patients your team is caring for? What do they really value? What's important to them? And in most cases, if you ask 100,000 people on the street what matters to them, it's being healthy.
Nah.
They don't tell you about their disease and diagnosis.
No, yeah.
Even though we all have them, right?
Yeah.
So for me, technology is simply about, what purpose does it serve? Mm. What success can it achieve? And can you measure it? So that you can demonstrate that, because first and foremost, patients need to be confident in that before they're even going to contemplate using it.
How do you, on that point around measurement, because that's where I was, my brain was going too, because it's one thing for us. We all get that, you know, we're in this to improve the lives of patients and improve, hopefully, levels of population level of healthcare. But in the end, there's got to be a driving why and a justification and a return on investment. I think some of the challenges also revolve around this point of finding it difficult to quantify and measure, say, the outcome from a patient side that might be tied to something that drives action, like a financial kind of point too. How do you go about, how can some of these, whether it be vendors or hospital systems or different stakeholders within healthcare, go about framing these solutions and the need to implement more technologies to drive those outcomes for patients that will actually get buy-in within these groups that need to have it?
It's a great question. And I maybe it's my nursing background, but I always start with, what outcomes do people want to achieve, particularly the patient? If you tell a patient, this is a great technology, you'll have a 2.5 day shorter length of stay. That's a wonderful outcome. It's a could be a financial outcome. It's certainly an outcome that serves the system. What does it do for me as a patient? And for me, that's what's fundamental. However, it's not just about what a patient outcome they're trying to achieve. It's clinician outcomes. If a particular technology gets integrated into a system and it makes me add 17 more clicks to the 30 I already have to get to that technology to answer those questions or document my patient's progress, chances of me using that? Yeah. Not so much. Mm. So I think we really have to ask the question, how does it serve the purpose of enabling people to stay healthy and well? And I get, and health systems really have focused more heavily on disease management, disease outcomes. Can we cure this disease? Can we treat that one better? And that's great.
Yeah.
But generally, people want to have the tools and the connectivity with their providers to stay healthy and well.
Yes.
Particularly as people are aging. And all of our populations are aging, some faster than others.
Yeah.
So keeping people healthy and well is not as great a focus as, from what I can see, in so many of these technologies, but could be. So that would be one area. But the other really has to be, any innovation, any digital transformation strategy has to meet the needs of all of the stakeholders. Start with the patient, because if it doesn't meet their needs, they're going to ignore it anyway.
Yeah.
Then look at the workforce. Is it possible? Is it something the workforce will embrace because it makes their jobs easier, their work environments better? Great. Then keep going. How does it achieve operational outcomes, performance outcomes that every global health system has to report on to their payers, whoever pays them, right? And how does it meet the needs of your C-suite? Those CFOs, they have to be convinced with some pretty hard numbers And the CEOs and board have to be able to justify it to their communities. So it's a multi-layered, and I think sometimes we forget that. We may focus on one, the patient getting better. Or we may say, this will help the workforce. Great. The fact is, it has to cover the whole system and be very focused on what each of those key stakeholder groups need to see. And that's when you get scalability.
Yeah. Do you find in satisfying the needs of all the stakeholders that it can be something that ticks all of the boxes? Because sometimes it can feel like it's a sliding scale. If we're leaning more towards the patient's side, we're pulling away from something else, and we're compromising in different areas. Is there outcomes? And it's quite a nebulous question, but are there examples or ways that we can demonstrate these benefits for all the stakeholders in reality?
It's a great question. And it the answer often in healthcare, sadly, I'm sorry, is it depends.
It's okay.
But most importantly, if your transformation strategy, whatever it is, achieves very focused one or two outcomes, maybe for the patient and the workforce only, then you at very least have to position what the domino effect, if you will, the downstream effect will be on the system and account for it. And I think that's often what I see missing too. We will have wonderful technologies that people will tell me will save people's lives. Wonderful. How are you going to measure that? And in order to do that, what are the other dependencies in this system that have to come together for that to be accessible? Yeah. So you can see it's a very system-focused strategy. The other thing we tend to do too much, perhaps, is focus on the acute hospital care, when the majority of the world actually get their health care everywhere else but, right? You might get into trouble and you need the hospital, and certainly we need them there and they do incredible work. But if 90% of the health system costs are with people's chronic conditions, those are all in the community.
Yeah.
So I think this is a time with the many technologies advancing as quickly as they are to be looking at how are we mobilizing communities? How are we supporting our most vulnerable, our patients at greatest risk? Do we even know who they are? And so many of the digital tools, and even AI in particular, could be exceptional at doing that, but we tend to get excited about that hospital cool stuff.
We do, and it is cool, but then and I also think sometimes it might be related to the fact that when someone, you know, when we need to provide the sick care of healthcare, where much easier, arguably, to measure in terms of the costs and the bed day saved and all of those things. If we're stopping people from getting sick in the first place, it's difficult to measure it if it didn't happen, if you know what I mean. So being able to quantify some of these tools that are out in the community and from a preventative side, and to do that, that's a tricky thing to, easy thing to say and a tricky thing to do.
Except if you created those tools so that the people... if you create those tools in a way that they were oriented to people helping themselves be healthy and well. So if I have my choice of digital tools, I might say, okay, it has to be on a smartphone, or no, I'd rather it be a website, whatever. And it allows me to establish with my provider teams my health goals. And I'll track my progress, and it helps me report what I'm doing that either gets me to where I want to go or doesn't. Now you've got patient reported outcomes, so you know from the very person you are most focused on helping, knowing whether we're in the right direction or maybe we should switch gears because it's not working. We know many products, drugs, technologies work for some and not others. We see that in COVID.
Yes.
And we've seen it for decades. But we haven't created those digital tools that help people help themselves and track their progress, so they learn what's working just as much as that nurse, physician, or team know what's working.
Yeah.
So that's where I would say I think digital transformation could have a massive impact, but they tend not to focus on that as much.
No, you're right. And you importantly said that, you know, there needs to be that focus particularly on the vulnerable communities or those that we may not even fully have direct connection with, those that need the healthcare the most. Do you think that there's a risk that with more emerging technologies being introduced and the excitement and the hype that comes with that, that potentially we may be widening the gap further when it comes to injecting more technology in and leaving some people behind that need to be included the most?
I do worry about that. We are just finishing a study of 2,000 U.S. hospitals who've completed an assessment of their digital maturity. So the good news is, these are 2,000 that want to know, how are we doing? 80% of them are at an MRAM level zero, which means they have an EHR, they have a pharmacy software, a lab, and an imaging, and a, you know, cardiac cath lab. None of them are connected. Our most marginalized population in the U.S. by zip code are far statistically more likely to be going to a hospital at level zero than a hospital at level six or seven.
Right.
So in my mind, would pretty marginalize that person further if those clinicians looking after our most vulnerable have to run around and find what labs did they last have? Who? When were they last here? What? How did that treatment work for them? What meds are they on?
Yeah.
That's a disconnected system that doesn't have the interoperability they need. But it is also a system where that patient hasn't got a chance of figuring out what's been going on if they did have a digital access point.
Yes.
Right? So, so I do really worry that the digitally less advanced or not at all advanced hospitals and other organizations may be further marginalizing our most vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we have to address.
Yeah. No, that is a concern. What do we do about that?
What do we do about that?
Yeah. Is there hope? Like, in terms of...
There's a lot of hope.
Yeah.
The first step is recognizing where you could have the greatest impact.
Yeah.
If I'm the chief nursing officer of a level zero hospital, I am going to push that board and that CEO really hard to get out of level zero, connect those fundamental operational systems so that as I walk into that patient's room as a nurse, all that data is there and I have a much better conversation and more data-driven decision opportunity to help that person based on where they last were. Because right now, without that level of interoperability, like none, I have to rely on that person to remember who said, what did they... I don't remember that. How do I expect them to... And I have to kind of knit it together and hope I get it right. That, for me, is creating a greater digital divide.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of... That's an easy fix. But unless you know that's an easy fix that can get you to many more important, person-centric, helping people help themselves, then it won't happen. So that's what I would suggest.
No, absolutely. And I'm glad you said that, you know, coming from the front line as well, I'm a big believer that some of these big system changes that are needed within, say, a hospital setting, they don't necessarily need to be driven from the top to start with. If there's this groundswell of that alignment of, well, this is good for the patient and there's the business outcomes that come with it too, then everyone will win. So there's certainly hope in that respect. Hey, look, we're coming near the end turn of HIMSS, let's say, and there's been a lot of conversations and a lot of great presentations and a lot focused around the discussion that we've just had. What excites you about, you know, leaving HIMSS 24 after this? Yep. And you've no doubt got a busy dance card and in the rest of the year. Tell me what to expect and what you're looking forward to.
There is so much opportunity and it drives me every day to figure out those really tough problems. Mm. Like we talked about, the marginalized populations being one of a big one, right? Building those collaborations you need to build with those incredible companies that have come up with these amazing technologies and helping them see where and how it can be embedded in a system to achieve great things. When we start working together and building those collaborations, not just with hospitals, our communities, our government ministries, we're both from countries where it's government funded.
Yes.
They need to be at the table to know what matters and how to get from where we are today to tomorrow. So the opportunity is unprecedented. It's mobilizing it and doing the hard work, but creating those teams across sectors, across organizations and systems, learn from each other to make it happen. That's what drives nurses, make someone's life better. And it's all right in front of us. It's just a matter. You've got all the cards.
Yeah.
Play the cards well.
I'm Don Woodlock. I run our healthcare business at InterSystems. Basically, InterSystems is a creative data technology company. So we're good at kind of managing healthcare data especially, but we have other verticals as well. But I run the healthcare vertical. And there's two product lines as part of that. So one is an EMR that we sell outside the states called TrackCare. And the other is a product line called HealthShare, which basically is something that pulls together data from multiple EMRs, kind of aggregates clinical data for maybe, you know, a regional health authority or a state or a region or a state in the U.S. Or provider, payer, anybody that wants to bring together the data on their patients or their members or their citizens to do research or help with point of care, decision making, that kind of thing.
Got it. And of course, InterSystems being no strangers to talking health tech,
especially
in the APAC region, which is great. So good understanding there. And that gives context, particularly for the US region. But we were chatting just before we started. There's a lot of exciting, interesting stuff happening with InterSystems. But tell me a little bit more about some of these projects coming up. I think you mentioned Project Best. Is that
Project Best? Yeah, I'll talk about that one. Yeah. So you know, the FDA, once they approve a drug, after the drug is out there, they have to do post-market surveillance to see if there's any adverse events.
Yeah.
With the drug. And providers are obligated to report on any adverse events. And this is all a good thing. But it's also a very manual process. Because when you see an adverse event, you have to fill out a form and then send it to the FDA. And then the FDA has to call you up and get the chart and blah, blah, blah. So we've been working with one of our customers named eHealth Exchange. They're a national network. And they basically have hundreds of provider systems connected to them. And the FDA is part of this project. And when an adverse event happens, the FDA can ask eHealth Exchange for the patient's record. And then eHealth Exchange will fetch the patient record from all these provider systems. So InterSystems is the technology backbone for eHealth Exchange. And this is all done via this FHIR standard, if you're familiar with that, that standard. So that's pretty cool because it saves an enormous amount of time. And the people at the FDA can get a complete picture of that patient and make sure it really was an adverse event. Because some of these are kind of false alarm type situations. And the other model that we're implementing is a push model. So at the provider site, it can look through events in the EMR and see whether there's any potential adverse events and then push them through the system over to eHealth Exchange, over to the FDA. The FDA can look at it and then log it as an adverse event. So it improves the amount of reporting that we can do, the amount of surveillance, the quality of the data, you know, lowers the workload of everybody involved. So so it's good. It's a fun project.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a great use case and example of the ability to, once you're, you can pull all the bits and pieces together and do it in a standardized, interoperable way and make sense of data and actually action things that you mentioned would be otherwise remarkably tedious or manual or just not able to do. So being able to do these things at scale is important. So all these issues, I guess, then come out, or the important factors around, you know, having secure data, having it accessible. So all of these elements that we talk about in this interoperability space is a great example of what you just said.
Yeah, there, so right? You have, you know, data rights are clear in this in this case. This is part of what we do as part of surveillance, data quality, accessibility. I mean, it's also actually a great example of this new FHIR standard. Because the way interoperability works in a lot of ways today is HL7 kind of copying the data around. So you have a lab system, and then the EMR wants to know about the lab test results, so you make a copy over into the EMR. And, of course, the FDA doesn't want a copy of everybody's medical record, right? But they want it on demand. So if there's an adverse event, just let me pull it for that one patient related to this med. So FHIR is more of a, you know, request, call and response kind of standard. We could say, I just want this data for this one patient. Give me it, please. And so it's a great kind of next generation interoperability approach that, you know, you wouldn't really be able to do this with HL7, this kind of use case.
That's a good example. And you mentioned, you know, next generation. And if I think about data, I guess combining those two things, no doubt artificial intelligence and generative AI would be front of mind. And you were moderating a panel, was that
Yes, yes. Yeah, this morning. Yeah, we just finished, actually.
Yeah, right. Well, tell me about that. What was some of the discussion points?
Well, it was called Gen AI's Got Talent.
Nice.
So we did a little bit of a game show.
Okay.
Gen AI was the contestant trying to prove the talent. And then we had three physicians from the Mayo Clinic, Mass General, Cornell and Vanderbilt.
Yes.
And they were basically evaluating different use cases. So we kind of live use cases where we'd say, hey, here's a patient, you know, summarize the patient record or what would you do next as a diagnostic test? And then the panel would sort of critique how Gen AI did at these different things. And it wasn't perfect, but it was useful.
Yes.
You know, this is kind of, we're really sitting on a breakthrough, I think,
yeah.
especially in the way clinicians relate to their EMR and the kind of user experience process. Generative AI can really revolutionize that. And so we're kind of exploring that.
Yeah.
That concept with these physicians.
Sounds like it made it through to the grand final then, is that right?
I actually asked them at the end whether they'd make it to the final round. Actually, two of the three said yes.
Two out of three.
The third one was worried about her job, so she said, I'd rather keep my job.
It's a conflict there. No, amazing. So there's those things going on, and those are the key topics. In terms of then, for InterSystems, what you're working on now, what can we look forward to seeing over the next 6 to 24 months?
So I guess the other thing worth mentioning, at least for the HIMSS show, is we have a bunch of our startup innovators in our booth.
Right. Yeah.
So part of what InterSystems does with our data platform technologies, we enable new software companies to build their applications or connect their applications to the EMRs of their customers. Because, you know, you can imagine there's rarely a software product that doesn't have to interoperate with something. Right. And we're specialists at that.
Yeah.
So we've kind of 9 different companies that are demoing in our booth that partner with us on our technology. I'll give you one because it's kind of cool. Actually, they're all cool. But this one named Lura Health, they have a diagnostic implant that you put in your mouth, basically, for continuous monitoring.
Cool.
So this is like it's almost like a continuous blood test, let's say. So it's monitoring your saliva for 1,000 different conditions that it can basically add value on. And it's just like a retainer that you can wear during the day and you can take out, that sort of thing. And it's a new kind of, diagnostic approach that's non-invasive, simple to do, can be done more continuously versus just I go into my doctor every couple months to do something. So it's kind of a neat approach.
I love that. And I guess that makes so much sense about partnership with InterSystems and where you would add a lot of value there, because the last thing I would want to do as a startup is, like, I'd want to be focusing on all of those front-end elements and the technology and the specialization about what makes the product different, because I know so much time and effort can be burnt in all the getting the back-end systems right, and no one's got the scale at the startup side to be able to do things as, like, in the way that InterSystems does. Kind of thing makes so much sense.
Interoperability is complicated.
Yeah.
And these poor startups have to end up being experts at interoperability unless they can find somebody like us that they can kind of offload that challenge to. And then this company can work on, you know, how do I get the most out of a saliva reading? We have other companies that do like pain monitoring by face, by facial expression, others that are doing diagnostics by breath. And so, you know, there's a secret sauce to each of these companies, which usually is not interoperability with your EMR.
Yeah.
And so they can focus on their secret sauce and rely on people that love interoperability. I mean, there's not that many of us who love interoperability. So, you know, might as well partner with us and we'll help you out in that sense. So that's usually our role with these startups.
Lee Kim. I'm with the Healthcare Information Management Systems Society. We're based out of Arlington, Virginia, and I'm the Senior Principal of Cybersecurity and Privacy.
That's the coolest job in town at the moment, I would say, in terms of cybersecurity and policy, because a lot of conversations around emerging technologies in healthcare and all of these exciting things you need to have in an industry like healthcare with a lot of sensitive data and important information. It's not too long from when you have a conversation about emerging cool technology in healthcare before someone mentions the importance of cybersecurity and the governance and everything around that information. So it must be an exciting, busy time for you.
It's an exciting, busy time. There's more than enough work, but I like the challenge.
Well, tell me a little bit more about like what's what you're seeing some of the key topics and themes are, stuff that's keeping you busy at the moment.
Sure. Key topics and themes. Gee, we just pushed out the 2023 HIMSS Healthcare Cybersecurity Survey, and certainly AI is of interest. Do we lend into our organization or not? But I could say companies like, name your favorite company that pushes out operating systems. They already have that embedded now in operating systems, and we see it in virtual assistants and everything else. So I would say Yes, absolutely. AI will be pretty much everywhere. Mm. The question is, are healthcare providers and other organizations ready for it?
And tell me a little, you mentioned this 2023 cybersecurity report. Tell me a little bit more about what that covers.
Absolutely. We asked some standard questions like cybersecurity budgets. Are you having enough money this year? And
healthcare providers?
To healthcare providers mainly.
Yeah.
And basically we're finding, yes, the budgets are increasing, but unfortunately in terms of workforce talent and people that are able to fill these jobs, there aren't too many people that are able and willing to fill these jobs in terms of their capabilities. Actually, people being able to find them. I wouldn't say necessarily that they aren't there, but somehow there's a disconnect between qualified talent and us being able to locate.
Yeah, interesting. Is there, that's a challenge that I think that's being felt globally in all parts of healthcare. And it's interesting to hear that that's also in the area of cybersecurity and governance. I mean, is it something that we try and address through in the earlier stage of education? But you mentioned that the people are out there, but it's just they're not being connected with the right roles. Like, how do we bridge that gap?
Well, it just so happens I volunteer for an organization called the National Cybersecurity Training and Education Center.
Okay.
And it's essentially a project that is funded out of Whatcom Community College by a few NSF grants. And essentially what they are doing nationally is that they are reaching out to K-12 so that within the school systems they're able to have some hands-on cybersecurity activities as well as education. So I think you're absolutely right. We need to reach out to people wherever they are. We need to reach out to people not only with the universities as well, but like I said, K-12 and two-year colleges as well.
Hey, but before this chat, you said that I could ask you anything on AI, and it feels like visiting Santa Claus and then deciding what my favorite gift is. But I think that if I was to take a measured approach to that question, we're in an era where there's a lot of cool things that could be done with AI and really impactful things too in terms of being able to reduce burnout, improve efficiencies, and reach more patients. But in an industry like healthcare, there's a lot of resistance, and rightly so, in terms of the data that we use. And I think a lot of it centers around this issue of trust, building that credibility and having that reassurance. And often the cybersecurity piece is really tied closely to that. So how do you think that we can bridge some of this uncertainty around AI and healthcare and build the trust of the clinicians, the C-suite, the key stakeholders that might utilize these solutions? Is it a matter of the trust, or is it something else that we should address first?
Well, absolutely. I think it's a matter of trust, but I think it's also a matter of education for these learning systems, right? Because they are machines. If we were to essentially interface with AI as if they were students and teaching them what's right, what's wrong, what the correct answer is,
yeah,
what a correct analysis is, instead of always assuming, oh, they're always correct. It's a machine, therefore it's infallible and it's perfect. I don't know about you, but I feel like in terms of healthcare, when things can turn on a dime, right, by the second, just accuracy of information, is there any kind of errors or mistakes or anything? Or, you know, because I certainly wouldn't want a automated thing not be fact-checked and for the model not to be checked rigorously. So I think we need that rigor. And again, from the perspective that AI is actually a student of ours as opposed to being our professor.
Yeah, I see.
Turning that dynamic around.
Yeah. What's the phrase I use? We want it to be Iron Man, not the Terminator. That's the augment the humans as opposed to destroy all humans. So what's your take on then, particularly coming from a policy and cybersecurity side perspective, thinking about innovation, the need to often synonymous with moving fast and breaking things in the startup space, which is not, we don't want to break things in healthcare, but we want to continue to innovate, move quickly. Some might look at governance and policy and everything as the brakes to innovation and kind of working in the face of innovation. How do you see innovation and moving quickly working alongside something like governance and security and all the other important bits?
So that is actually my favorite question.
Oh, good.
Because we were speaking to someone who is a U.S. registered patent attorney. Hello. So that aside, okay, let's break down what innovation really is, right?
Yes.
So innovation, as you know, is the state of the art and overcoming the limitations currently, the problems in the state of the art. So in order to advance, you always have to overcome these problems and everything. So if we are to advance any kind of organization, harness it and yet leverage it, because we all need to grow. Otherwise, we die. That's true of anything in life, right?
Yeah.
So notwithstanding that, you got to just keep on having an organized, risk-controlled way to constantly test assumptions, grow your technology capabilities, and yes, grow your knowledge with AI, but feed that through your risk committee. Say to your organization, okay, leaders across everything, HR, legal, business, I don't care, everyone, you know, does this make sense?
Yes.
Are we going to make this step? But you always have to move forward. So I would say, I don't think that they're at crossroads. I don't think they should be at loggerheads. If they are, I think your system's broken. But notwithstanding that, I think that, you know, it all should be parallel tracks. In fact, I think it should be the same path. And that's essentially what you're saying and what I'm saying.
Yeah. I get the vibe, at least in Australia, and actually it'd be interesting to know if this is the same in the US as well. What we're finding is that there's pockets of good where regulators or the government or those that are seen in previous lives for say a vendor community might think, oh, I need to work out ways around this regulation or at least just tick the box and because it's being imposed upon me. More recently, I feel like particularly with faster moving emerging technology or in this landscape where it's continually evolving, there's a bit of collaboration and there's a bit of like, hey, we're learning this together. So like, what do you want to do? And let's work out how this works. So is there a bit more collaboration like in the US, particularly in a much larger health system? Or is it still feel a bit like, well, let's chuck it over the fence and see what comes back?
I think there's a bit of both.
Okay.
There is chaos and yet there's order.
Yes.
And as you know, where we have governance and order and good progress, there's order out of chaos.
Mm.
And I think we need to get there. And I think that you hit the nail on the head in terms of what's going to happen. We need more coordinated information sharing. We need essentially feedback to government, from government, as to what is working and what is not.
Yeah.
And unless our voices are clearly heard and we can grow in terms of solutions, let's look at, some might argue it's US-centric. I think that it's more global. But things like the NIST cybersecurity framework, there were comments from all over the world about that, right? And each individual voice mattered, whether they were government or private sector or otherwise. And I think that that's the kind of collaborative approach that really matters, because I volunteer for USDHS, the Analytic Exchange Program, not a government employer or contractor. But I'm here to say that there is certainly approaches and intelligence that government has, even at the unclassified level in the U.S., but there's also a lot of information that private sector has that government doesn't even know about because they aren't as big. They don't have as, you know, the impacts are different. Government is oftentimes concerned about confidentiality. In terms of healthcare here, we have a single-payer system with VA. But in terms of healthcare, at least in the U.S., we're private sector, right? So we have all these learnings. So
yeah. We
have to work together in a public-private kind of way. And I would frankly encourage it, you heard it here first, for us to work together, even the U.S. and Australia. Why not? I mean,
there's
awfully, awfully great, and I'm a fan. Australia has gotten it right in terms of cybersecurity and information sharing and being one of the best, actually, in terms of being ahead of cyber threats, as far as from what I've heard for years and years. So thank you.
Yeah. Maybe the word didn't get out about some of these recent threats that came. But anyway, I digress. No, I hear you. There is certainly elements of that. Always work to be done, though. And then thinking then about the future in terms of all the different work that you're doing, you mentioned the 2023 report. Can we look forward to something coming up in the future?
Yes, we have these surveys once a year.
Okay.
Everyone is welcome to take them as long as they are in healthcare cyber. And that is something they do, even if it's part-time or virtual or your full-time gig. And we're continuing to look forward and we're continuing to test assumptions. Because if there's one thing we have to worry about in terms of cyber attackers and our defenses, you can never assume that innovation or craftiness is going to be static. They'll be doing things where you aren't looking or where you assume, okay, this is safe and secure.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a signal in view of what happened, unfortunately, with Change Healthcare and otherwise. Just a signal to look at what you think is just simply true and rock solid. Is it? Is there a plan B?
Mm.
The Talking Health Tech podcast has evolved a lot over the years. all based on audience feedback. Now I need your help. Yes, you, to shape the future of this show. Between now and the end of June, we're running our biggest campaign to date in order to understand what makes the global healthcare ecosystem tick. Last time we ran our Talking Health Tech audience survey, we learnt 40% of our audience are clinicians, 77% of our audience tune in for professional development and market awareness, 8% of people listen to Talking Health Tech for competitor profiling, and only 2% of people listen to the podcast to fall asleep. And this time around, I can't wait to find out about your preferences for audio versus video content, which topics we should dive into more, preferences for hosts and formats and geographical reach and so much more. And don't worry, we'll be sharing all the insights once all the responses are collected as well. So if you're a supporter of Talking Health Tech and you can spare 5 or 10 minutes, please complete our 2024 audience survey. And to say thanks for your input, everyone who completes the survey goes into the draw to win a share of $1,000 worth of credits towards THT Plus membership. Go to talkinghealthtech.com/survey or the links in the show notes of this episode as well.
So I'm Dr. Eyal Zimlickman. I'm a physician, an internal medicine physician, and my role is Chief Innovation and Transformation Officer at Sheba Medical Center, Israel's largest hospital, ranked as one of the top 10 hospitals in the world.
Yeah.
And I'm also the founder and director of the ARC Global Innovation Program.
Amazing. It's great to see you here at HIMSS. And Sheba, always seen as that, you know, iconic center for innovation and healthcare in Israel. Tell me about what brings you to HIMSS and what are you excited about?
So, you know, HIMSS is our usual platform. We come every time to HIMSS, but this year it's a little bit more special. We came in with an announcement of what we think is transformational technology using generative AI together with our partners, KPMG and Microsoft, to have a patient-facing application in the mental health space that's able to really move the needle on access and quality of care to large populations.
Yeah, excellent. So generative AI, all the rage at the moment, and it's one that there's a lot of potential, but it's difficult to see like the real-world practical applications right now. Like where do you see this kind of innovative technology happening? Is this something that we're going to see in a couple of years' time, or is this something that's happening now?
I think it's coming along very, very quickly. Machine learning or proper AI, as we've known it before Gen AI, was an evolution, right? It was slowly sort of seeping into healthcare, creating an impact. Gen AI is a revolution. Mm-hmm. This is something that will come in very, very quickly. And we've seen the capabilities. I mean, it's just been over a year since this announcement was made by Microsoft and OpenAI. And already we've seen huge and, you know, advances, starting from GPT-3 all the way to GPT-4.5. Mm. The abilities have really, really increased. And that, of course, is very interesting to think about what's going to happen in the next couple of years, having this trajectory continue.
Yeah. And tell me a bit about what this use of Gen AI will practically look like. How will people engage with it? What is the thing?
So specifically what we're releasing or the evidence we've released during the HIMSS conference, we're looking at and developing at a tool that's a conversational app, patient-facing, where you have the Gen AI speak with any patient. That after a conversation of about 20 to 40 minutes on average, the Gen AI is able to make a diagnosis or recommend a diagnosis, is able to recommend a severity for that diagnosis, and also recommend treatment, both medication as well as psychotherapy. This could serve many, many purposes, right? I mean, this is just the capabilities we've shown in the clinical trial, showing more than 90% accuracy in the Gen AI compared to a human psychiatrist. Where do we take this next in terms of applications? There's a wide array. Mm. And of course, initial applications will be more careful that we are not hurting anyone. That's primary on mind, of course. But then with time, we think this will actually have even more applications. And as we know, mental health suffers with huge amount of issues with accessibility.
Mm.
This could be really game-changing in that regard.
Amazing. Yeah, look, I mean, I can see the potential for increasing accessibility. You know, we've only got a limited number of human clinicians that can see patients. Where do you stand on, you know, often when we talk about AI and ensuring safety in AI in healthcare, we always like to incorporate, say, a human in the loop in the process of diagnosing a patient and having the AI as the intelligent assistant for that. Where does that fit in with this particular model where the the Gen AI is diagnosing after a long consultation with the patient.
So, right. So this would serve as a decision support for doctors. Mm. Of course, the Gen AI will not write a prescription for a new drug for a patient or even make a diagnosis and give that diagnosis to the patient.
Mm.
What we're seeing is two uses. One is, of course, to help the clinician make better decisions. That's number one. And we're already doing this with more of the traditional AI for a couple of years. So that's nothing new. But the other thing is, you know, with accessibility issues, if you are seeking mental health care and you want to set an appointment and you get an appointment set for the next month, that might be too late for many patients.
Yeah.
So right now we're missing a lot in terms of providing the right access to care for patients who really need it. So imagine when you're looking to schedule an appointment, somebody is able to triage and say, listen, you have to see the psychiatrist tomorrow. Please come 9 a.m.
Yeah.
Versus you're fine with waiting a month. Mm. Here are some digital tools we can give you in the meantime so that you're not left hanging in terms of some capability to answer your problems.
Well, and that's what we do in healthcare now, isn't it? The triage, perhaps with a nurse or with a technician or somebody to be able to streamline that process for the doctor to make the ultimate, you know, kind of decision and continue to do care in a scalable way. If we can do that more effectively, technology that makes a lot of sense. I know you need to run to go to the airport and have a thing, but lastly, can you tell me about like what's coming at Sheba? What are you excited about and maybe where can we see you next?
So sure. So, you know, basically ARC, our innovation platform, which is now active in almost 20 countries with 160 partners around the world, you know, we're looking to transform healthcare. We're looking to answer to the many critical issues like the ones we just talked about with mental health and accessibility, but there are many, many others. So we're looking for those game-changing technologies, and AI definitely is a primary goal right now. It's a focus area for us, but not just that, also remote care. And we also talked here at During IMS, as we talked more about mental health, about our hospital at home programs for mental health. Huge issue, because we know the stigma of patients who need to get hospitalized for mental health treatment. There's a huge issue with accessibility, for example, for eating disorders to get the high level of care. There's huge issues with accessibility to care for postpartum depression, depression after pregnancy, where sometimes the child and the mother need to be separated because the mother goes into a psychiatric hospital if she's in a severe condition. How do we move all of this to the home? Given the technology we have today, given our ability to do risk assessment and know who's the right patient for a home environment, we're able to move about 50% of the patients today that are hospitalized to the home environment. And of course, in mental health specifically, that's a game changer. Mm. So this was sort of a deeper dive into mental health, but the same thing is ongoing with ARC around the world in many other domains.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, good morning. Dr. Jigar Patel. I've been at Oracle, formerly Cerner, for 17 plus years.
That's a long time. Sorry.
I joke with people, I have the long view on things now.
Yes.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But I've done from a clinical perspective, you know, I'm a clinician at heart. I've done most aspects of the product lifecycle from a client perspective, from an Oracle Health perspective.
Yeah.
That's everything from sales to implementation, consulting, ongoing client relationship, and most recently product management. So I've gotten around the block a little bit on all the different aspects of the business that we have.
Yes.
So I bring a broad view of the world as well, having helped clients implement software, having helped develop software now, having sold software. So a little bit of everything across the board. Background, well, clinically is pathology. Transfusion medicine was my subspecialty.
Yeah.
So I'm also a little odd in that space as well, because most of the folks that do jobs like I come from primary care or emergency department or hospitalist medicine. So just also a little bit of an oddball that way.
No, that brings a good perspective. I'm gonna hazard a guess and say that there's probably been a little bit of change in that 17 years of your time working with Cerner to Oracle Health now.
Yes.
And I guess the hot topics now, you know, that we're all discussing at HIMSS, these have been front of mind in some of your discussions. Is that right? You've had a couple of sessions that you've been moderating.
That's right.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the key kind of themes that you've seen come out of HIMSS.
So yesterday I moderated a panel where we brought some folks together and talked about interoperability and the implications of AI on interoperability.
Mm.
And how do you think about AI helping and assisting in that way? And it's really, I think the conversation boils down to it's a front-end thing as well as a back-end thing, in that AI will help inform better exchange. The data will be more relevant when you exchange it, easier to consume. But then also, once you get the data, how do you consume it in a different way to surface it to clinicians? So a lot of the interoperability space over my career has been about standards. And those standards build you into, or box you into standard formats and those sorts of things. And one thing we've seen here in the United States is a general distaste or dislike for the format because it doesn't tell a story. So from a clinical perspective, you've got great data, but it doesn't tell a story. So on the consumption side of that data, how do I potentially take that and turn it into a story so a human clinician can relate to it and understand the patient better as well? So that's it's an interesting way of thinking interoperability, because interoperability is fundamentally an exchange of data. But then how do I format and send out and then consume that data can be radically transformed with AI.
Yeah. And if I think about it, so if we're spending all this time and effort, resources, and brain power on, you know, let's make all the data really interoperable, like if the end goal is just to make it much faster to bill for healthcare, that's kind of, we're missing a lot of the point. We hope that correct. A lot of the reason that we're doing this is for a lot of other reasons.
That's correct. And I think that the one connection I think people don't make sometimes between the data in the patient and finances is the story helps you accurately assess what is the work I'm doing as a clinician worth. So the creation of this is a more complicated condition than this is what we learn in medical school, but AI and other technologies can help you condense that in a way to say, oh, this is that nugget that can justify better compensation, especially here in the United States where we do fee for service. The diagnosis is everything. And how well you code it ends up with the financial implication.
Yeah.
Governments have done similar sorts of things, and they've used various proxies. In the United States, we use a note as a concept for how in-depth or how sick or how much time did you need to spend with this patient. It's based on what you've written in a note.
Yeah.
But over time, it could be just the data doing it for.
Interesting. And so, you know, you kind of touched a little bit on the, you'd hope that the data then would help clinicians to understand the story a little bit more for a patient, which could then result in hopefully better patient outcomes.
Right.
But there's impact internally for the clinicians as well, Lauren, on, because we also talk about workforce burnout and inefficiencies within the system. So there's got to be positive implications there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we have done, as a person that's worked with electronic health records my entire career, we've done as much as we can with the technologies we had to surface data, but it has become overwhelming. Part of the burnout that you can blame from an EHR perspective is, how do I find all the right information? The chart review time is substantive in having to hunt and pack and find that information. While it's more accessible than ever before, it is also extra work to go do, and it causes that burden, not just from a time perspective, but from a cognition perspective. We've done some recent prototyping where we're saying, okay, if I asked AI, summarize a patient's diabetic condition for me, that AI could take 15 seconds to spit back a narrative, relevant data elements very quickly and easily. If I had to do that in a traditional electronic health record, it could take 18, 20, 25 clicks and could take 90 seconds, 2 minutes to put that whole story together. And that's if you're a super user, you know the record really well and you know where the data is. But often you don't know where the data is because it's buried in some consultant's note from 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But AI can find that very quickly and make it easy. So I think we're on the cusp of having technologies that can actually reduce burden. We always thought we were reducing burden by giving more information.
Yeah.
That's actually inaccurate. And I think we were coming to that realization that's inaccurate. And so now we have technologies that might actually make that better.
Yeah. You've alluded a couple of times to, you know, these technologies becoming available. And I guess I'm going to guess that it's a bit of a convergence of, you know, some exciting change for Cerner, now Oracle Health.
Yeah.
But also just in the macro environment of technologies being available. How do you see that convergence then and the opportunity to utilize some of these emerging technologies to really kind of lift the game and meet some of those objectives we've been talking about?
Yeah, there is going to be some fundamental redesign of the things we've done in the past. The legacy ideas of how we present data, the legacy ideas of how do we structure data? We've gotten to enough compute power where do we really need to structure data at all? Because I can extract from unstructured in real time almost without a problem. So it begs the question that we've tried to structure and create relational databases over my career, and we could ask the question, do we need to at all anymore? I can actually get it from all these various sources and use technology to tell a story.
Yeah.
So it we do have to rethink a fair amount. That's going to be uneasy for technologists that have been working in this space for a really long time. Clinicians are actually probably going to be really happy about it because they're less focused on the technology. They're more focused on the story, the care, the how do I help this person feel better, et cetera.
Yeah.
How do you think about then this important and exciting need to think strategically and redesign and everything? But there's also a lot of hospitals that are using it on a day-to-day now, and there's things that got to happen yesterday.
Yeah.
They're two quite very different vehicles to drive.
Yeah,
right?
They are different vehicles. And so you've asked a very good question in that, how do I ease the burden of clinicians' movement from current state to a future state?
Mm.
One of the strategies we're taking is fundamentally don't change the data model, change the user experience. So if I don't monkey with potentially a less than optimal data model, if I don't mess with it but understand it and redesign the user experience, I can actually move faster potentially on how do clinicians get released from the burden of the cognition that goes with it, but also the time.
Yeah, and I guess wherever possible, where the technology can work behind the scenes or not get in the way, and if anything, allow the clinician to do more patient-facing time. And that's, I think, where we speak about, you know, not messing with the workflow and all of that. And they're all really important things. So that's great that it's front of mind. Thinking then, like, you know, we've talked about what's happened to this point and what's happening right now. Where do you see then the exciting opportunities in the future? We've touched a lot on interoperability and AI and that combination of both. And then what can we look forward to seeing?
It's not a great technology answer. It gets back to the... we've got technology that's advanced enough to make the technology invisible.
Yes.
An example is the product I get to work on every day, Oracle Health Clinical Digital Assistant. You basically put your phone on the table, it listens to your conversation, and it helps you create a note. And then it has all the great downstream effects of codifying data and other things that can help with interoperability, but then also satisfy regulatory, statutory, safety, quality needs in a way that, but I get to have a human conversation because fundamentally patients they're in some of the most vulnerable moments of their life when they're sharing information with a clinician. And when they do that, we owe it to them to pay attention to that. And that return to humanity is an interesting evolution of the technology getting so much better. So the evolution of the technology is going to lead to a de-evolution of the practice, because the practice is going to go backwards in that now we're focusing on the patient, the interaction, and not worried about the technology.
Absolutely. And actually, final question, you've probably attended a few HIMSS in your time then, I'm going to imagine, and we're IBS 24. Anything you'll take away from this one that might be a little bit different or at least provide you some reassurance or excitement about the future?
You're right. I've been to, I think, 15 of these on this,
that's
at
a few
this
of,
point.
Yeah.
And after a while, they're all very similar. There's ginormous booths everywhere and exhibit space and those sorts of things. I do think, and every year has a hot topic. You've done enough of these now, too, that every year there's a hot topic.
Yeah, yeah.
And the hot topic kind of, it's a carousel and goes in. The one thing I think that we're going to see more of is collaboration across companies. One of the things we talk a lot about is multi-cloud environments. And how does a client decide what cloud to use? Well, we believe use whatever cloud you want, or use pieces, parts of whatever cloud you want, and use the best of what you decide. So for a long time in the electronic medical record space, it was all about everything in one place. But technology is also moving us backwards in that way, in that the technology is good enough and the APIs are available that I don't have to think about them sometimes.
Yeah.
That I can move data, and it gets to interoperability as well.
Yeah.
That interoperability becomes even more easy as well. So my takeaway is, I think, and the thing I'm going to take away from this is, I think this is, for me, it's going to be a little bit of a HIMSS where I think about how collaboration among companies and collaboration with clients that may use my electronic or medical record or not is going to be different, and it's going to change over time. So that's what I'm going to take away from this.
Mm.
Hi, Peter. My name is Cherry Drulis. I am a clinician. I am bringing about 30 years' experience to the Samsung healthcare team. My role at Samsung is I am the director of the healthcare mobile B2B enterprise team, leading a team of AEs, engineers, and business development.
Love it. And so thanks for coming, Sherry. And tell me a little bit more about Samsung in the healthcare space, because obviously Samsung, well-known brand generally. I'd love to learn more about what you're doing in healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. I get that question asked a lot because most people think of Samsung as the cool refrigerators and the bespoke line, but we actually have an enterprise side of the business as well. And over on the healthcare side, we really focus around mobile technology and how we can leverage our technology paired with our partner. We have a partner ecosystem that brings the SaaS applications. And then we're addressing different focus areas within the healthcare space. We primarily are looking at digital care delivery models, and that incorporates really all things that are required to provide care to patients and meet them on their own terms. We also focus our offerings and our solutions around efficiency at the point of care. So how do we improve those workflows for care providers, whether that care provider is a provider, a clinician, or even your own family member in the home? How do we make that care more efficient? And then we have another focus area around decentralized clinical trials, really looking at how do we take that traditional pull methodology into a push methodology and take the trial into the comfort of the home of the individuals participating in those studies.
Yeah, fascinating. And I guess it sounds like it's engaging with the healthcare ecosystem in, like, for different stakeholders as well. Maybe if we just unpack each of those a little bit more. You mentioned at the front there it was like a partner ecosystem. Or am I understanding, like, the IT provider perspective, or the on the vendor side, is that right? Tell me a little bit more about how you're engaging with the IT professional crowd within the healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. So we work with SaaS partners. So keep in mind, we are a hardware company. So we provide all the digital touch points for solutions. So we need to put content on that hardware. So that's what our partner ecosystem is about. So if you're looking at an interactive patient care platform, we have partners that can provide that technology that we then put on our hardware to bring those solutions to life. So I always like to tell our customers, think about us as the enabler to bring your solution to life on the best digital touch points possible to bring efficiency and ease of use with deep integration for your care team.
You mentioned there's also a patient-facing aspect as well, patients engaging with the technology. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So we cover the entire continuum. We don't just think about the caregivers. We keep the patients top of mind, and the patients are the center of all of our decisions we make at Samsung. So we also have applications and solutions that allows the patients to also communicate with their care team and their providers, whether that's through telehealth visits, through RPM capabilities, or even when they're in the patient room, being able to communicate via digital monitors, digital type technology, so that they can feel like they're a part of their care and they have a voice in the care that they are receiving.
Yeah, interesting. And then I skipped over the middle bit, is the care providers there. It sounds like that's an important element to the work you do as well.
Yes, absolutely. So the care team is very important to us as well. We really want to make sure that the care team has the best devices at the point of care when they need them, really about the efficiency, making sure that whatever device we implement for a solution, that we have that deep integration for that seamless workflow. We don't want it to be a heavy uplift or another device they have to carry. We really like to implement solutions that a device could be a multi-use device, so that we can simplify it. So let me give you a little example of what I'm talking about. So you traditionally see nurses walking around the hospital pushing these really large workstations on wheels. We have the ability to come in there and eliminate that big cart with that heavy PC on it and equip our clinicians with an X-Cover 6 Pro, which can be all things, right? So they can use that X-Cover 6 Pro to provide the care they need to provide to their patients. by simply leveraging a capability called DEX that is on our devices, which stands for desktop experience. So now imagine you are a clinician walking around the hospital with this handheld device, a phone, that we have fully customized to meet the needs of that clinician. So they can use that device to make calls, secure texting. They can walk into a patient's room, scan an armband, see their medical records, look at their MARS, give medications, and if they need to display that on a display over at the foot wall of the bed, we now can have that come up on the foot wall of the bed. The patient can see their plan of care, look at their medication review. If the physician wants to review an x-ray, they can pull the diagnostics up, talk about their diagnosis with the patient. We really bring that deep integration and flexibility to streamline the workflow to impact the overall experience of the clinician and the patient.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I'm sitting here thinking that, you know, if the strategy, like you're dealing mostly in the hardware side, I guess, if you look for externally, but the more you dive into it and with the deep integration or understanding you have of the various stakeholders, I mean, one strategy could just be that Samsung gets a bunch of distributors and sells physical stuff and people just work out how to use it and that's it. But this is way much more than that in terms of partnering with those different players in the ecosystem. And then I guess that integration between the ensuring that those solutions are well integrated into your product, because there's that physical engagement.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one of the things is I'm really big on trust.
Yeah.
And transparency. So when we work with our customers, we're there from the beginning throughout the entire partnership. We don't just sell hardware and walk away. We're there to make sure that they're getting the fullest potential value of that investment and that it is being implemented and used as intended with that use case.
Mm. And I guess once you've got that trust and you've got that relationship, it allows you to do some cooler things too. I guess there's, you know, we were speaking before we started around some, you know, space around utilizing artificial intelligence or other kind of emerging things. Tell me about, like, what's on the horizon and stuff you work.
Yeah, so I get really super excited. So we call that the art of the possible. And I'm always challenging myself and my team and our clients to think about the art of the possible. Don't think about what we know. Think about what we don't know and how we can push the boundaries. And if you're thinking about a workflow and it just doesn't seem right or you think it can be done different, let's talk about it, right? Let's figure out how we can take our technology with the right SaaS applications and figure out what the future of healthcare looks like together. I always say we need to collaborate, innovate, and partner, because together, as that cohesive partnership, we'll do greater things in healthcare than just as a single thought track with just one point of view.
Speaking my language there, but then, you know, you alluded to the question about the future of healthcare. Mm-hmm. From your side, where do you see some of the future opportunities in the healthcare space?
Yeah, I think we're just really scratching the surface of what the future could bring. So I think AI has a place in healthcare. We are still trying to figure out how to leverage AI in healthcare, what AI can actually do, not only for the care team, but the patients, to enable them to be more owners and steward of their own health.
Yeah.
When I think about the future of healthcare, we at Samsung, and a lot of people do not realize this, is we have a medical center that's in South Korea. We built our health facility. It is state-of-the-art 5G. And we host our customers there. We invite our customers come to look at our healthcare facility. We have leveraged all of our digital technology. It's a 5G-connected hospital. And from the moment you walk in the door, it just eludes patient experience, and you feel like that concierge. We like to take that, replicate that in our other customers. And what's really nice is we have this healthcare system that we have built. And we have it so customers can come and experience it on their self to understand what we bring and what our legacy in healthcare is. It's more than just devices. We have, like I said, a healthcare system. We have a small diagnostics equipment company as well. We have AI ultrasound machines for sonography. We own pharmaceutical manufacturing companies as well. So we produce mass drug productions for 13 of the largest pharmas in the world. A lot of people did not realize that. Samsung has a very deep legacy in healthcare, and we are every year now evangelizing that story.
Hi, Peter. I'm Kaveh Safavi. I'm Senior Managing Director at Accenture in our healthcare group, and I work across all of the geographies that Accenture serves, and I serve all of the client types, so funders, delivery systems, technology companies, and I spend my time helping them think about how they're going to be able to use the promise of technology and human ingenuity to solve some of the problems that are most intractable in healthcare.
Yeah, excellent. No, look, I mean, well-known name within the healthcare space globally, Accenture. So it's a great opportunity to learn a little bit more from you now about where some of those priorities are and what you've been up to and what that means. So I guess here at HIMSS in the US, you mentioned there's a bit of a global view that you have, but a lot happening here in the US. Tell me about some of the key themes and topics that you've seen that resonate with you at the moment.
Well, when you talk to people in healthcare in any country, you see some combination of three concerns: access, affordability, effectiveness, or quality of care. But their balances are different in different geographies. But what I've seen in the last year or two, especially coming out of the pandemic, is a convergence in all geographies. Whether it used to be quality of care or it used to be affordability, it's all becoming much more shaded by the reality that we're running out of people in the workforce to do the work.
Mm.
And whether that is an access problem or a quality of care problem or a cost problem because it's driving labor costs, the root cause issue is really a challenge. And it is driven by the fact that the number of people who are aging, so let's say over 65 on a global basis, will be 50% larger in the next decade.
Wow.
But that population consumes healthcare resources 3 to 5 times more than people under that age. The number of people alive working to support either people under 18 or retired goes down by 25% in the same time period. So we have a non-linear gap in terms of the demand increase relative to the supply decrease.
Mm.
And that plays itself out as waiting times. So if you go to Northern Europe, where it's well known in many countries, the waiting time in the NHS for an elective procedure now is 18 months. Mm. In Ireland, it's 2 years.
Wow.
In the U.S., in some metropolitan areas, elective procedures can be 3, 4, 5 month wait. Now, that's not 18 months, but for Americans, that's an ungodly amount of time to be waiting for a service.
Joe.
And that is mostly related to nurses and somewhat related to doctors. So the buildings are there. There's no staff. So you can't book a patient. You can't book a procedure. And that problem is getting worse because of a combination of demand going up and retirements, but also people have other options for work. They don't necessarily want to work in healthcare. In many cases, the pandemic cause people to choose other sectors of society. And it now has become an intractable problem, and we can't solve it by thinking we're going to recruit our way out of it. So we have to rethink how we're going to scale human capacity, create more units of clinical labor. And the only way to do that is take a job, break it into tasks, and then ask the question, where can this task be done better? Can it be done by technology instead of humans? If it can be done by a human, which human? What skill? What location? And then you have to reorchestrate that to get the work done.
Mm, mm.
And that all goes into what is happening right now. And whether you're a provider or a funder, that's the problem that needs to be solved.
Yeah, it's not a immaterial problem for sure. And it's one that's being faced globally, as you say. It's not like the doctors and nurses are leaving one country to go to another. It's a pain that's being felt everywhere. There's a level of irony that sometimes those on the front line might talk about how one of the biggest pain points they have is how the burden that's been placed on them by technology, in terms of how a lot of things have been driven by, you know, I need to do so much more now because I'm plugging stuff into fields.
Well, that's objectively true.
Yeah.
And it's explainable, because if you look at the history of healthcare information technology, you can follow it back to the late 90s when patient safety and quality of care was an issue. The United States, there was a Institute of Medicine report, seminal report to Eras Human, the equivalent of one jumbo jet per day of patients dying because of error.
Yeah.
This set off a global patient safety movement. And we first started by looking at processes, taking variation out. Then we said, let's hardwire the processes. And we said, let's use technology to hardwire the processes. We brought in technology to bring things like decision support and workflow assistance in. Well, we need structured, computable data. How do you get that? You have to type it.
Yeah.
Because a transcript of a doctor's note isn't machine actionable. So we introduced not just movement of documents, but structured data as a requirement. It has objectively been quantified in the United States, a 13% loss in clinical productivity due to typing. It's the only sector in our economy in the last 2 decades that has seen a reduction in productivity due to technology.
I didn't know that.
We made healthcare safer, but we did it at a price, and no one cared until we ran out of people.
Mm.
We can't roll it back, so we're going to have to find a path out. Now, the good news is, optimistically, generative AI and large language models specifically have shown up in our arsenal, but only in the last year. But what's elegant about them is that they can take over reading and writing tasks. And that allows us to envision, and we see active development of a whole bunch of technology products, such that most people who are close to the business would say that it is plausible that within 3 years, the technology will exist to eliminate the need to use a keyboard as a way of interacting with an electronic health record, giving people time back.
Mm.
Now, that time has to be repurposed to solve the access problem.
Yeah.
So giving them time back alone doesn't solve the problem, but you can't do it without the technology. Mm. What we're recognizing now, and people are recognizing, is technology is necessary but not sufficient. But for society to gain a benefit, we also have to go back and remodel the work of the person. That is a different problem than the tech implementation.
Yeah.
And that is the sequence that's starting to play itself out now in organizations at an executive level, once they understand how this is going to actually proceed.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, is that shaping a lot of the conversations you're having with the different stakeholders that Accenture works with globally? Yes. Around these?
Absolutely.
Challenge.
Yeah. I mean, so it starts with things like we need a foundation of our technology. Okay, great. But we also need to start addressing this issue of who's responsible for reorchestrating work.
Mm.
And we're seeing increasing efforts around things like, what is my model of operation? Because about the silos, the way they're organized today, the IT organization doesn't own this problem. Human resources doesn't own this problem. In theory, the operators do, but they really weren't selected or trained to do what I'm... They're trained to run their function. They're not trained to change the work of the people.
Mm.
So that's a big question. And the people who are going to do that need access to both the technology and the human resources. So that's a whole big area. And then we're also seeing a much more fundamental question that goes to this issue around how is this going to get paid for? Because you need an investment before a return. And we have been, in general, running our healthcare systems pretty hot on purpose. And so finding the resources to make the investment, finding the slack in the system, whether it's money or people, to create the change is its own challenge.
And I think about some of the things I've seen from Accenture in the past, often do a great job of synthesizing some of these complicated issues into insights or reports or information to go back to the ecosystem and the industry. In this area where we're moving so quickly in terms of generative AI, are there some insights or some things that people can point to and kind of get some objective data and try and make some decisions that can be, yeah, through some of the work that you've done?
Well, so like, for example... We started by just looking at asking the question, what is the potential impact of large language models on work?
Yeah.
We know empirically now that about 40% of all tasks done by all people in all jobs is amenable to language models materially affecting them. About 2/3 of those things are automated and about 1/3 of them are augmented. The difference being, in the automation world, the person stops doing the task, they get the time back.
Mm.
In the augment, they do the job, they do it better. That may create a better experience or more productivity, but it's still human time. In healthcare, it's a smaller number, but we know, for example, for healthcare workers, around 20% of tasks are amenable to automation. Another 10% are amenable to augmentation with the capabilities that large language models have. Okay. The second thing we know is that, and we're starting to see this, is that it affects different workforces differently. If you were to look, for example, at nurses where we see a problem, and I took 10 nurses in a hospital today doing traditional medical surgical ward work, the target workforce is not 10 people doing the same job on average. The target is actually 6 people plus 4 bots, but the bots are taking 40% of the tasks, not 40% of the jobs.
Right.
The human part is reorganized into 4 people who are doing the same thing all the time and 2 people who are doing highly specialized things that come and go. So we now have an adaptive and a fixed workforce and technology. When we coordinate them together, we get the work done.
Mm.
The key, however, is that no jobs are actually eliminated. That's one of the real challenges, because we're taking only a few percentage of someone's task, but we're reallocating the human side. So consider it this way. I give you 20% of your time back, and now I have an 80% productive person. Mm. I have to take all the 80s, accumulate them, and redistribute them as new 100% jobs.
Yeah, I get that.
So I still have a job, but it's a slightly different job with a different concentration of tasks.
Yeah.
That's how this plays itself out as an example.
That's a nice structured way to think about it. That's and it does provide that reassurance, I think, at least from my side, is that it's, the narrative around AI coming to take everyone's job. I think when there is that fear on the side from the clinician, even at the hospital exec side, and on like the uncertainty in that piece, I think with more education, understanding, and the kind of in-depth analysis of like what the impact will be, I don't think there's any other option other than to explore these tools for the reasons that you explained already. So I feel like that education and awareness piece is going to be critical over the coming months. So it's not years, it's months.
It actually goes to another area, which is what we often describe as technical or technology literacy.
Yeah.
It has become very apparent to us that no effective business leader can be an effective business leader without understanding technology. No different than expecting a CEO to not understand a balance sheet or a P&L.
Yeah.
They need to understand technology.
Mm.
And we went through a whole process as a company, 780,000 people, building what we call a technology quotient in starting 3 years ago.
Mm.
We are actually seeing so much demand that we are now actively investing in a whole set of capabilities to build basic technology literacy in all workforces and all industries everywhere. Because everyone needs to start somewhere. Otherwise, they don't understand what is being talked about.
Mm.
And then they have inappropriate fear. Things are not intuitive. They can't be intuitive. If no one explained to them what these concepts are, how will they begin to approach their job?
Mm.
So there's a lot of specialized learning that has to occur, but there's a foundational level that we all workers are going to need to have. And we're beginning to see organizations ask us for just that answer, which is help me build basic understanding and literacy in my workforce in anticipation of the fact that their jobs are going to change.
Yeah, there's no way around it for sure. That's super important. Hey, lastly, I feel like we could chat for a lot longer, but lastly, as we're kind of in the middle of HIMSS at the moment and a lot of conversations around these topics that we've touched on, but a lot else too, and from your experience, what are you taking away from this particular session and or what can we look forward to seeing from Accenture over the coming months and where your priorities are? You've kind of touched on the priorities already, but what can we look forward to seeing?
Well, I think a few things are happening. For us in particular, we're going to continue to go from these abstract notions to how do you actually begin to change jobs. And one of the big questions, of course, is can you change the job of a single person or do you have to change the tasks of multiple people in order to get the work done? That's a challenge that organizations are struggling with. Like, do I take one nurse and fix the nursing role? Or do I take a task that nurses do that connect to social workers and connect to doctors and get that right? So we're going to spend much more time getting that right because everyone is looking for where to start this process. And it's almost so big that if you don't have a framework for starting it, that's necessary. I think what's interesting, too, is this problem is a globally unifying problem, which means I can actually talk about it in every country I go to. And it resonates. And that is creating an interest in people sharing with each other answers. That's a little different than what we'd seen in the last two decades when the emphasis had primarily been on affordability. And because financing is so different, what was driving affordability many times was very country specific.
Yeah.
This is not country specific.
Mm.
And so I think there's a different kind of an opportunity. And we as a company that serves healthcare organizations in all geographies really sit there. This HIMSS is actually very interesting. I've been coming to HIMSS. This is my 21st HIMSS.
Wow.
This is by far the most global HIMSS event.
Mm.
7 countries worth of my clients are here today at this event. That was not true 21 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think that's also representative of what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
My name is Nick Vass. I'm the president of J29. I've been with the company since inception, which was 2017. Just a little bit about my background. I started on the health information exchange side. So I work directly with regional health systems and hospitals and even the statewide HIE up in New Jersey. So I am a Philadelphia, Pennsylvania native. And today for J29, I support a lot of our growth strategy, a lot of our delivery and operations for about 150 to 160 employees.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to learn more about that in a moment. But and what about yourself?
Absolutely. My name is Tracy Mills, and I'm the CEO and founder of J29. I started J29 about 7 years ago after a nearly 20-year career over at the Department of Defense. And I just really had a desire to step away and create what I thought was missing in the government contracting space, which was an employee-centric, people-centric company that empowered its employees to do good things for others, to use the contracting dollars that we get to benefit people in the community as well. So J29 is named after my favorite Bible verse, which is Jeremiah 29:11. Mm. And along with that, we tithe our earnings to nonprofit and community efforts every month.
Amazing. I want to dive into that in a moment, man. But what I, firstly, it's interesting seeing the connection of the two here in terms of the, you know, what you do in the healthcare space in particular. So I want to dive into that a little bit first, and then we'll come back to a little bit more around that why. So in terms of the what here at HIMSS, and you talked a lot about the HIE space. Tell me a little bit more about what's happening on a day-to-day in terms of what's happening at J29.
Yeah, absolutely. So we really focus on supporting health and human service programs at the commercial, state, and federal level. So our area of expertise is, I would say, a combination of clinical, policy, and data analytics focused, where we're really drilling down on patient claims, patient data, appeals, disputes, audits, again, at the patient level, provider level, and even the insurance plan level. So, you know, for us, even taking a little step back as a healthcare management consulting company, where the consulting piece comes in is we'll partner, again, with commercial, state, federal agencies to come in as that independent party, that consulting party, that third party. And what that really means for us, as we're giving policy, clinical, you know, data analysis perspective, we're independent in the fact that we don't have financial ties with a larger insurance plan. We don't do work with health systems. So we stay as independent as we can and really provide that policy interpretation. Maybe it's provider analytics or provider integrity that we're looking at. So we touch a little bit on the fraud, waste, and abuse space and that aspect. So that's kind of where we are as a company. And, you know, really for us, I mean, about 6.5 years old. So as we've continued to grow, we've been very fortunate that we know what we do well and we know what we don't do, you know, well. And we're very transparent about that with our clients that we'll, you know, partner with. So this week at HIMSS, I mean, you see companies of all different shapes and sizes and everything under the healthcare landscape. So it's very appealing for us to understand what companies are doing well now, what they've been doing, and where they want to go with the use of some of the innovative technology that we see in the room here. So, yeah, very rewarding week for us.
Absolutely. And it's in terms of then the institutions, organizations, or groups that would then partner with you, it sounds like then the real benefit then is around the interpretation and the domain expertise. Is that right? Is that why? Because of the complexity around the area that you're operating in?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'll give you an example. On the federal side, we partner with Department of Health and Human Services a lot. Mm. Oftentimes, you'll see HHS look for companies, consulting companies like our own, who have the expertise but aren't necessarily representing HHS. We can come in with that clear mind, that independent, that third party mind, and help them interpret policies for appeals decisions, arbitration decisions. We'll do data analytics, just as an example, for maybe we're doing a drill down audit on providers. Where are there abnormal billing patterns that we might see examples of fraud, waste, and abuse? We'll work with CMS to say, hey, Dr. Nick, as an example, has had abnormal billing patterns on this, you know, service area, on this medical code. Maybe you should do an audit. Maybe there's something that needs to go to Office of Inspector General to kind of find those outliers. So, yes, domain expertise, the policy expertise, but also the clinical understanding in-house. So we really put that full circle where you know, we do have the technical expertise, but we also understand the domain side, which is very, very needed, especially when you're dealing with large-scale programs on the federal side.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'd love to dive more into this, you know, a bit more about the why with the organization and the what's brought you to this thing. And I think you mentioned something along the lines of it being a people-centric organization. And that's something that a lot of organizations say because it's easy to say, and that makes a lot of sense. We should be people-centric, but saying things is a lot easier than doing things. It sounds like you're really walking the walk. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more like how you do that and why this.
Like I said, we tie their earnings to different nonprofits every month. And a lot of times we'll talk to our employees. We'll find out what's near and dear to their heart. We'll find out what they're walking through personally in their lives. Because when you make those efforts relative to them, you inspire them. You know, at J29, we talk about passion, purpose, and perseverance. When you know, like, for instance, we have an employee whose daughter has diabetes. So supporting their local diabetes foundations is very important to her. We have her come on our company calls and tell those stories, and then other people can see. Because at the end of the day, everybody's getting up every day for a job, and you want that job to be purposeful, and you want to like it. And when you create that environment and your culture for your employees, they're going to love their job. And when they love their job, they're going to take care of your customer. And when they take care of your customer, you have successful programs. And to me, again, so many companies say, you know, that they're people-centric, that they're employee-centric. But what are they really doing? I mean, here at HIMSS right now, if you walk around and spend any time, you'll see these huge, elaborate booths that cost so much money from these companies. But, you know, this year, as I mentioned, we're the HIMSS Gives Back sponsor, and we're a small company. This is how we choose to spend our marketing dollars, yet that effort goes towards a local nonprofit. And I think for J29, it's sort of also a call to action for these larger companies. You have a great booth, but we're all here today at HIMSS. It's about creating tomorrow's health. Well, let's start today. Let's take a little bit of that money that you'd be spending at your happy hours and your parties and in your booth and give to the local community and let these people know that we do care about tomorrow's health and that it's starting today.
Yeah, I'd love to learn more about I absolutely resonate with your message, by the way. I think that's amazing. The HIMSS Gives Back program, because that's something I only learned about in coming to HIMSS, and it's an amazing program. Tell me a little bit more about how that works.
So HIMSS Gives Back, like I said, every year when they have their conference, they pick a nonprofit that's local to that area. So for this year, it's up Orlando. But Gives Back also provides scholarships to people in other countries that need scholarships. They provide certifications for healthcare professionals in other countries who otherwise wouldn't be able to do that. I mean, the HIMSS Foundation is very far-reaching. And I don't think that a lot of people know about it. But again, I think that if your foundation is good in any company and you're looking at what you can do to solve issues for the greater good, to have that impact, to inspire your people, then you can, you know, look at what's around you and how you can immediately contribute to it.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly something in that message there of, you know, when thinking about the next marketing budget for next year for some of these industry partners, it would make have the boost, but there's also an opportunity to then contribute back to the community that we're making a, you know, we're having a strong presence in. So there's a way to really have that direct impact that we're all in healthcare to do anyway, well, one would think. So yeah, that's a really strong message, and that's would be inspiring for others as well. Something that happens a lot at HIMSS as well is we talk about the emerging technologies and new exciting themes and topics, and based on what you were talking about there in terms of the support you provide to organizations, some of these would be front of mind for you, I imagine, too, in terms of those hot topics and themes. What's kind of caught your attention during HIMSS?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, you spend 5 minutes in the exhibit hall and it's very clear, you know, where technologies are going from an advanced technology perspective and artificial intelligence perspective. So there is certainly that elephant in the room. And I think for us as a company, you know, AI is a hot topic, but how is AI applied to that business use case, right? Everyone has a different business model. And for us, it's really getting an understanding at what is our data telling us? What is our labor-intensive process flows right now that we could start to even have that as a topic of discussion. You know, in full transparency, we have conversations with partners and they'll throw out the word AI. Hey, use AI. What are you doing with AI? There's a roadmap to get there, right? It's not as simple as, hey, let's implement this product and boom, we're an AI enabling company. For us, that starts all the way at the data cleansing perspective, right? What is the data set that we have access to? You know, what is our control capabilities around that? How do we get that to a point where you know, we could even implement robotics process automation. Maybe it's very basic manual tasks. You take a step further and a step further to where, again, we get to the point where we could even talk to AI. So, you know, I think for companies out there that are kind of sitting on that word of artificial intelligence, I mean, you have to develop that business use case, because for multiple businesses out there, not maybe they're not, you know, applicable in that category right now to use AI, and that's okay. They don't have to be, but it's definitely a hot topic. Again, I think for us is we really have to look in the mirror and understand our business model and what we do, because that's different from other companies and they might already be using AI. Okay, great. I mean, you know, we might still be developing that use case, like I said. So again, for us, it's, you know, understanding our business model and what we do and formulating that business use case, because before we even get to the point where we're having technology related decisions and conversations, again, there's a lot of legwork that we need to do before that. So definitely something that we're looking at. I think all companies are, you know, looking at that and how it gets implemented into their business, but definitely a long road there.
That's
yeah.
Hey, thanks for sticking around to the end of this episode. If you made it this far, you're the perfect person that I want to hear from. Our THT Plus audience survey is now open until the end of June, and I personally read every submission. In fact, if you leave a comment in the survey that you heard this promotion in a podcast episode, I promise I'll reply directly to you by email with a personal note of thanks, and I'll even buy you a coffee next time I see you in person. It's pretty easy. Just go to talkinghealthtech.com/survey and have your say.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Health Tech. Make sure you like and subscribe and share this episode with someone who might find it valuable. For more information and resources about healthcare innovation, visit talkinghealthtech.com.